Okay, I will call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:47 p.m. on Thursday, February 8th, 2024. Present today, we've got Representative Josephson, Representative Hannan, Representative Galvin, Representative Stapp, Co-Chair Representative Edgman, Co-Chair Representative Johnson, Representative Tomaszewski, Representative Cronk, Representative Ortiz, Representative Cologne, myself, Co-Chair Foster. And before we start, just a reminder, if folks could please mute their cell phones. This afternoon, we'll be taking up three bills. First, we'll take up House Bill 89, that is Child Care Grants. This is the second committee hearing that we've had on that bill, and we'll take up the two amendments that we've received. Then we will review fiscal notes, and if it is the will of the committee, we'll move that bill out of House Finance. Second, we have House Bill 178, which is Village Safe Water Facilities. We'll hear from the Department of Environmental Conservation about their new policies regarding the best practices scoring system. And then finally, we'll hear House Bill 193, which is Internet for Schools. This is the second hearing for the bill in House Finance. We'll hear a brief recap on what the bill does. We'll hear from the Department of Education. I'll discuss the importance of the timing of this bill. And then we'll take up public testimony, set an amendment deadline, and then set the bill aside. So before we get going, also I just want to give folks a heads up on House Bill 50, which is the carbon storage bill. We've had six committee meetings on this bill. The plan is to have two more meetings. The next meeting will be for members to have one more opportunity to ask questions. And at that meeting, we will also set an amendment deadline. And then the final meeting will be to take up those amendments. And if it is the will of the committee, we'll also pass that bill out. So moving on to today's schedule, first up is House Bill 89, Child Care Grants. The committee does have two amendments for this bill. So with that, if there are no questions, we'll head right into that. And I would entertain a motion, Representative Cologne.
Chair, I make a motion to move Amendment 1.
Okay, and I will object for the purposes of discussion. If you could please explain your amendments.
So this is changing two dates in the bill. One was just an error in drafting the page 22, the line, page 22, line 4, deletes January 1 to 2025. To insert January 2026. This date was requested by the department, and they can explain why that date needed to be changed.
Okay. So
Department of Health, would you
okay,
like
great. To do it? So with that, if you could put yourself on the record.
Good afternoon. For the record, Leah Van Kirk, Healthcare Policy Advisor for the Department of Health. Through the chair to Representative Kalum, we are requesting the date change in this section because it aligns with our federal Child Care Development Fund application and when we receive approval for that. So in July of 2024, we'll submit our three-year Child Care Development Fund plan, and then the Administration for Children and Families then has time, and it's not a specified time to respond and approve that plan.
Great, thank you. Does the committee have any questions on the amendments? Seeing none, I will remove my objection to amendment number one. Representative Plum, do you have any further comments? I'm
no
thinking not. Okay, thank you. So I remove my objection, and seeing no other. Okay, actually, I will not remove my objection. Representative Josephson?
Chair, so the deadline for the federal government to review this question of whether we can move to a cost of care model could not be met within 6 months of the completion of the state's supplementary report in July of this year?
Through the chair to Representative Josephson. For the record, Leah Van Kirk, Health Care Policy Advisor for the Department of Health. So in speaking with the Child Care Program Office, the typical response time from the Administration for Children and Families is approximately 6 months. And so we did not want to put this in jeopardy of not meeting that timing guideline. However, this could be implemented sooner if we are approved for an alternative methodology prior to that.
Thank you.
Okay. I will remove my objection and see no further objections. Amendment number one to HB 89 has been adopted. So with that, we'll next move to the next amendment, and that is Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I move amendment two.
Okay, and I'll object for the purposes of discussion. Representative Galvin.
Thank you. I'm very supportive of this bill and feel like it's a really good start to addressing our deserts of childcare, and I'm very grateful for all of the work done. I believe that this amendment would make this effort stronger. Currently, the bill has a wonderful limited program that will be supporting employers and their beneficiaries, their children, which is fantastic. And if we look at the larger piece of legislation at this around this, the tax credits, we know that the state has issued this opportunity for investing for the private sector to invest in university level and many other things that support our children's needs, and I'm grateful for that. And this slides in another lane, another opportunity. So that the tax credit would be able to go toward the state program, that is the state child care grant program. That child care grant program is currently in existence. It used to have a cap, and this bill does remove the cap, and I'm grateful for that. But this amendment allows for tax credits to be issued if the private sector chooses to go into the state child care program. And the reason that's important is that we know that could change the whole landscape for child care opportunities. If we were to fully fund the child care grant program, we know we would see opportunities to expand and stand up new child care facilities, whether they're at home or place-based. We know that an example of the work that the child care grant program, the statewide program, could be is what happened in Juneau. So 4 years ago, and this is in your packet, if you would turn to the page, it would be just before the SEA IAC, so Southeast Alaska Association. So just before that page is the description of this amendment. And it explains what the grant program in Juneau has done. And mind you, we have a statewide grant program that hasn't been funded to do these same things, but this program was modeled after the state program. So what it did was gave more opportunities to families who needed the extra stipends. It also helped the new program set up. And it, as a result, I've heard from those who are administering the program that we no longer have the desert in Juneau that once was, and that the child care average wage is $18 in Juneau instead of the statewide average age, which is $12. We heard from the task force that wages was a major concern. So learning that this program in Juneau, which is the child care grant funded, it was modeled after the state program, was a real kickstart to me to tell me to think about how can I help integrate that opportunity into this bill since we have a bill on child care. And this is an opportunity to create another lane. That's what this amendment does. It's pretty pretty basic. Like I said, we already have an opportunity that exists. that wherein we can invest in our universities and in other spaces. That's written in here, and now we're offering the same sort of public-private partnership for this investment in our Alaska state-run child care program. Grant program, pardon me. So that's what this amendment does.
Great, thank you. Do we have any questions or comments, Representative Klum?
So as I appreciate your passion around this. I know this is a really important topic for you. I can't support the amendment, mainly because I'm trying to get the private sector to take care of their workers and to see child care as a benefit, and I don't think that it would be helpful to divert any of that money to a state fund where it's basically managed by a middleman. So I can't support the amendment. I'd like to keep it the way the bill reads right now.
Okay. Representative Kronk.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. With this amendment, is there any additional fiscal notes that come with it?
There's not a fiscal note attached to it, no.
Representative Kronk.
So does that mean there's no additional funding needed for it, or is that just we just don't have a fiscal note?
Well, no, actually, the program already is in existence. The state child care grant program is already in existence, so there would not need to be something new or new administration around that. This just means that funding would be put into that program that serves the greater state as opposed to the employee program.
Okay. Representative Stapp.
Yeah. Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair to Representative Galvin. So I am a little confused on the description. Can you tell me, you highlight the Juno Child Care Grant Program, and we have a state child care grant program. My understanding is what your amendment would be to take these tax credits, basically allow them directly to go to the state child care grant program. But what is the actual difference between the state program and the Juno program?
The Juno program is not funded by the state program. That's the primary difference. But it was modeled after the state program in that the goals are the same. They're trying to expand child care opportunities throughout, in this case, the district here. But it is that the goals are the same. And administratively, I think they modeled it the same way, except they had AAC be the manager instead of the State of Alaska Child Care Grant Program. This did not take away the opportunity, just to address other concerns. This does not take away the opportunity for businesses to choose to only support their own employees in child care. If they chose that lane, they could still do that. This just offers another lane in case there is a business entity who wants to impact all of child care in Alaska, like many have done with our university system. It's I think that we need to think more and more about public-private partnerships in that way. So this does that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Representative Klum.
Through the chair to Representative Galvin, it's my understanding that the Juno program subsidized wages for child care workers.
I don't think it did it that way, no. My understanding is the wages did change naturally. This is what I was told. So I could be wrong, but this is from Blue. I think what happened was it happened because there were more dollars circulating in for child care. So the families would get a stipend, and that would give them extra money to pay more to whatever the licensed child care provider was, or is, because it's happening still now. And then the other way money was spent, similar to the state program, is they were helping startups, so with new or folks who needed materials for their child care business, that was also the monies are also used for that.
So we had a Juno rep on the task force, and I remember them saying that they were subsidizing wages. So whether that's happening or not, that's one thing I don't want to happen. I don't believe in subsidizing wages. So that was my concern.
And, yeah,
you know, if you put it in a fund, that can start happening. And I want the marketplace to fix that.
Representative Josephson?
Can I respond to that, if I may? Thank you. Again, like I said, the way it has been read to me is that with regard to wages, with the program in place, average salaries, so they weren't all exact, the average salaries for child care workers increased from $12 to $18 per hour, an increase of 50%. It was not given to me any information about what you're speaking to, which would be subsidized wages.
Okay, Representative Josephson, then Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'm going to support the amendment. I have concerns that it may be underutilized because of sort of the self-interest of employers, which I would share if I were the employer. In terms of the question of subsidizing wages, I think that indirectly, because we can't compel that, most of us want that to happen. And that's what Juno has succeeded at doing. In fact, that's why we applauded grants, receipt of generous grants during COVID, and more recently, $7.5 million this current fiscal year, and are concerned with the absence of continuing funding. The stakeholders, groups like THRED, the Alaska Children's Trust, et cetera, are seeking $30.5 million. This bill is effective at opening up these potential avenues, and we're doing that in part to encourage employment, which isn't meant to be, as I said, a compulsion to pay $18 an hour, but a prayer that sort of wage would be paid. So to help support the industry broadly. So I just wanted to talk to that point too, but I'll be supporting the amendment.
Thank you. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, through the chair. For Representative Galvin, so you used the what's happened in Juneau as kind of the basis of the model for this particular amendment. And you talked about how the wages in Juneau went from, I can't remember the exact number, but they went up, which is a good thing. What were the forces, if it wasn't a subsidy, what were the forces that caused that to happen?
Representative Galvin.
Thank you, through the chair. So there's a fund that was put together and by CBJ, and what happened was they asked AAC, Southeast Alaska Association for Education of Young Children, to manage it. And the monies then were distributed to families as there is a federal distribution as well that the representative is working on to increase the opportunity for those subsidies. But that fund then was used to help licensed daycare providers to have materials for families also who can't afford the high cost of childcare to have a subsidy. For infants, it was $400 for full-time. For full-time preschool, it was $100. And I believe this is a monthly subsidy amount for full-time childcare assistance and so on. So my understanding, the way they distributed it, is that there's more dollars in the whole universe of childcare here, and that has impacted and lowered the need. In fact, our understanding is there's no desert here. There's no problem for families to be able to get childcare here in Juneau. So that is a huge change, and it happened in only 4 years, which is amazing. So it turns out sometimes it does take money and this is how they distributed it. We know that the state has been working really hard on it, on this issue, but there's been a cap as to how much money they've been able to spend. So state dollars could go straight into that fund right now, today, or we could open this lane also for those who are experiencing this problem throughout the state, but and they're paying in corporate income tax. This creates a lane for them to impact the greater need. And everybody knows that children are showing up 1 or 2 years behind at kindergarten, 80% of us, of our children at five. And so to have a licensed childcare where they're learning and being able to get the best practices of readiness for kindergarten to me seems so important. And I think there are many, I've heard from so many of our businesses in this state. We just heard from the chambers and they really want to see more readiness. And I think this gives a big kickstart to our K-12. And so I'm just happy to see this grow. And if private industry wants to kick in and help the state as they're doing this work. Like I said, this was modeled after the state child care fund program. And so I'd love to see that program funded, and then maybe they can do the same work.
Okay, Representative Stapp.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Foster. So I'm going to oppose this amendment, and my logic is going to be kind of the same argument that the sponsor of the bill actually objected to the amendment. Reason being is I see this problem as an employee benefit issue, right? So what I like about the bill and reserving the tax reductions for the employer itself is because I look at this as a two-piece problem in the employee benefit package. Number one, you have incentives for the employer to think and care about child care. And I think if you couple that with kind of the Section 125 dependent care FSA to allow the employee to pre-tax payroll deductions for the purpose of child care expenditures, which is already in existence, very underutilized. We talked about Chamber of Commerce. I had my Chamber of Commerce poll their own members to see if they utilize that program, right? So I tend to think as HB 89 rolls out, kind of the way the sponsor's design, you have a really good package in which you have the incentive structure based for the employer to really consider child care as an employee benefit. And I think more people are going to utilize Section 125s going forward, especially when HB 89 is out on top of them. So thank you, Co-Chair Foster.
Okay. Representative Hammond.
Thank you, Chair Foster. I guess I'll just chime in that I will be supporting the amendment in some communities, like the community of Juneau. A lot of the employees are state employees. Putting more money into the grant fund by putting it in the hands of the individual parent allowed then the daycare serving state workers and private company workers to increase wages. So it wasn't a direct subsidy, but because you had more people able to pay a higher price for the care they were receiving, then the wages went up. And Juneau happens to be one of those communities where, especially seasonally, we have a lot of jobs that you can walk through the door with no experience and you start at $18 or $20 an hour. So the child care sector, I think, especially if we have some bigger corporations, we have a couple of large operational minds here. They're our largest private sector employees. Many of them do not have families living in the community. Their workforce is migratory, but the corporation, they're non-resident. They fly in from other places, but that corporation being able to put some of their tax benefit into the rolls of the community helps with the employees who do reside here. And it would still reside with the taxpayer, the company, as to whether they want it to just go to their own employees or whether they want to benefit the public sector. So I'll be a yes vote.
Great. Thank you. Representative Galvin? Oh, Representative Tomaszewski, and then Galvin.
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair. It sounds like a great idea, but without the proper fiscal note and the actual, cost laid out, I have a hard time voting for this. But it sounds like it might be something that would be better introduced in its own bill and actually vetted through committees instead of just talking about it for just a few minutes here in this committee. So I'm going to have to decline the amendment. Thank you for offering it, though.
Representative Galvin and Rep.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate the discussion. I think it's important that we appreciate the broader challenges that childcare is experiencing and all of the families and all of the employers. Again, the reason that this doesn't have a fiscal note is that there is no extra administration to it other than we already have a childcare grant fund. So this means that the credits then would go toward that. Or they may choose to instead, some companies are going to want to take care of their employee and their needs separately, and I appreciate that. I just am grateful for the opportunity to be able to put in an amendment and have this conversation. I think it's important that we have it. I think that giving funds to families creates more demand for childcare, which this also will do. And then natural market forces would be expected to increase the cost until the supply equalizes with demand. And so it's not surprising that the supply would only equalize when the care providers are making a living wage. That's just pretty basic economics. And so we have to figure out how to get to that puzzle piece in a way that's for all Alaskans, particularly in rural Alaska, where they don't have the same tax base that we might have in other places. So this is an opportunity, like I said, to spread this conversation in a bigger way. And I'm grateful to you, Julie, again. Representative Colomb. I'm really supportive of this bill, and I appreciate the opportunity to perhaps make it a little bit stronger. Thank you.
Thank you. And I objected for the purposes of discussion, so I'll remove my objection. Are there any further objections? Okay, we have an objection. So with that, Madam Clerk, if you could please call the roll. And we are on amendment number 1 to HB 89.
No, 2.
Sorry, we're on amendment number 2 to HB 89. Madam Clerk?
Representative Colomb?
No.
Representative Kronk?
No.
Representative Stapp?
No.
Representative Tomaszewski?
No.
Representative Galvin?
Yes.
Representative Hannon?
Yes.
Representative Josephson?
Yes.
Representative Ortez?
Yes.
Representative Edgman?
No.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Foster?
No.
4 yay, 7 nay.
And so on a vote of 4 yays to 7 nays, amendment number 2 to HB 89 has not been adopted. So that takes us through all of the amendments. We'll now move over to reviewing the fiscal notes. We do have two fiscal notes. One is from the Department of Health. One is from the Department of Revenue. So first we'll hear from the Department of Health. If we could have Ms. Leah Van Kirk come back to the table. She is our healthcare policy advisor, and if you can put yourself on the record and walk us through the fiscal notes.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Leah Van Kirk, a healthcare policy advisor for the Department of Health. Today I'll be presenting the fiscal note from the Department of Health on HB 89, referencing OMB component number 1897. I'd just like to call your attention to the date of this fiscal note. We made some technical updates, so just want to make sure that you have the fiscal note from February 7th, 2024.
Let's see. Yep, I have got February 7th. I think everybody else does. Okay, please proceed.
Thank you. So the total amount for this fiscal note is approximately $6.1 million. And I'm going to start by jumping into the grants and benefits line because that makes up a majority of this fiscal note. So these projections represent the cost to provide a subsidy to families whose income is above that 85% median income, state median income, and up to 105% of the state median income. So there are approximately 18,000 children, additional children, that are 12 and under, that would then be eligible for subsidy at this increased state median income eligibility requirement. So we developed a series of assumptions to calculate these projections. such as the average state rate, and you'll see that in the table on the fiscal note, as well as the 7% copay cap as indicated in this bill. And we broke these calculations down by 5% increments. We then calculated the total based on a 7% utilization rate of all children eligible, which mirrors the current utilization rate for the child care assistance program currently. And that resulted in a total of approximately $5.6 million. In order to administer these additional subsidies, one accounting technician position for the child care program office would be required to process payments directly to providers. And then the child care program office utilizes grantee organizations to determine family eligibility for the child care assistance program. And there would need to be four additional eligibility technicians to support the increase in requests for eligibility determinations. We would also need one program coordinator, one position, and that would be required to implement the program within the child care program office, to partner with private sector entities to create incentives for employers to developing on-site or near-site childcare, which is referenced in the bill. And then pointing out that all of these staff positions are eligible to be funded through 50% federal funds and 50% GF match.
Okay, thank you. I've got questions on the fiscal note. Representative Josephson?
Through the chair, I apologize. Are you Ms. Brewer? No.
Ms. Van Kirk?
Van Kirk, okay. I'm looking at the author here. Sorry. Ms. Van Kirk, in the child care grant program component, what does the budget contain without this? Do you know what the governor's operating budget contains without this $6 million?
So through the chair to Representative Josephson, the child care assistance program receives approximately $22 million in federal funding. And a required 70% of that is to go toward direct services, which would be subsidies for families.
Follow up?
But the state contribution of that 22 is nothing. And under this bill as written with this fiscal note, it would jump $6 million of GF, correct?
Through the chair to Representative Josephson, yes, that is correct.
All right, thank you.
Okay, further questions on the fiscal note? Seeing Representative Stapp.
Yeah, thank Co-Chair Foster through the chair, too. sorry. I'm just curious, would the range 12 step the accounting technician actually qualify for the child care benefit under the fiscal note?
Through the chair to Representative Stapp, I can look at those wages and make that assessment. It would be based on family size, so it would depend on the family size.
Thank you.
Okay, I don't see any further questions on this fiscal note. So thank you, Ms. We'll move to the next fiscal notes. So next up we have also Ms. Van. Wait, no. Mr. Michael Williams from the Department of Revenue, Deputy Tax Director. Looks like he might be online. Looks like he is. Mr. Williams, if you could put yourself on the record and present the fiscal note to the committee.
Thank you. Through the chair and committee members, my name is Michael Williams. I'm Deputy Director of the Tax Division for the Department of Revenue. I'll preface my comments by saying that the fiscal note we submitted predates some of the amendments that have just been made, and so we will submit an updated fiscal note to reflect the amendments that have been adopted. That said, I will jump to the analysis on page 2 of the fiscal note. The education tax credit is a credit for qualifying contributions to Alaska universities and accredited nonprofit Alaska 2 or 4 year colleges for facilities, direct instruction, research, and educational support purposes. Donations to a school district or state or regional operated vocational school, programs and facilities, and donations for Alaska Native cultural or heritage programs for public school staff and students, and donations to a facility in the state that qualifies as a coastal ecosystem learning center under the Coastal American Partnership. The credit is available to be claimed against insurance premiums tax, title insurance premiums tax, corporate income tax, oil and gas production tax, oil and gas property tax, mining license tax, fisheries business tax, and fishery resource landing tax. The credit for any one taxpayer cannot exceed $1 million annually across all tax types. The credit is currently scheduled to be repealed effective January 1, 2025. This bill would expand the education tax credit to include donations made to child care facilities, employer-run or nonprofit, for the children of the taxpayer's employees, or for payments made to an employee of the taxpayer for the purpose of offsetting the employee's child care costs. The new provisions would take effect, and this will change the update to 90 days after the bill is adopted or signed into law. This bill also would increase the credit limit from $1 million to $3 million annually per taxpayer. The bill extends the sunset provisions to January 1, 2028. The change in revenues reflected in this fiscal note only include those eligible tax programs administered by the department. The bill's fiscal impact can be divided into three categories: expansion of the education tax credit to child care facilities and employer costs, to increase the annual tax credit limit, and to extend the credit repeal date. The revenue impact of expansion of the credit to child care facilities and costs cannot be determined because the Department of Revenue does not have Alaska-specific data to estimate how many taxpayers will claim the expansion of the credit, how many taxpayers currently pay their employees child care costs, or make donations to child care facilities for the children of their employees, or how many taxpayers will start paying their employees child care costs or making donations to child care facilities for children of their employees. The revenue impact of the increase in the credit limit is estimated by applying historical information at higher credit limits and interpolating the impact of the $3 million credit annual credit limit in the table below. The revenue impact of the increase in the extension of the repeal date is estimated by using the average of the last 3 years of actual credits claimed as a basis going forward. So in the table, you'll see that it presumed that at a later start date, but with the amendment, that fiscal 25 will become a full year at $4.7 million, which we'll submit an updated fiscal note to reflect that. Then the out years would remain the same fiscal, $4.7 million at fiscal 26, fiscal 27, and then a half year of fiscal 28. Based on a January 1, 2028 repeal date. Other sources of uncertainty stem from the high contribution limits and high cost of care in Alaska, as well as the fact that the credit is available against multiple tax types in Alaska. As far as implementation, this legislation would require the Department of Revenue to make minor changes to its tax revenue management system. Resources required to implement this bill would include staff time and updated tax forms, programming in our interims, and revenue online and other miscellaneous costs where, when applicable. These costs will be absorbed by the tax division using existing resources. And that concludes my comments on the fiscal note if there's any questions.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Williams. We got a question, Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Mr. Williams, we had an amendment moments ago that would have constrained the credit in a couple ways. By noting that the deduction could not be also allowed as a deduction under 26 U.S.C. 170, and also noting that the deduction couldn't drive the liability under $0. And I see that language in Section 5 of the bill in part, but not elsewhere. So my question is, and I'm asking you because this is, I think, your lane, should we be worried that those, the belts and suspenders that were on the amendment that didn't pass, aren't mostly in the bill? Or does it, I mean, because this is just beyond my current pay grade to understand. So we need your expertise.
Mr. Williams?
Through the chair, Mr. Representative Josephson, the most of the statutory language in AS 43.20.014, for example, which is the corporate income tax for which I'm most familiar, that constraint on IRC Section 170 already exists, and it remains unchanged by the proposed language of the bill. So the constraint under 170 still remains in law, even with passage of HB 89.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Stout.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Foster. To Mr. Williams, through the chair. I actually have a very similar question as to Rep. Josephson. I hadn't really considered it until a moment ago when you talked about employer-run childcare facilities. A few years ago, the IRS gave guidance about commuter spending accounts and employer deduction, pre-tax deductions, where they couldn't spend pre-tax dollars on a parking facility that that employer owned at the same time. So I'm curious if we are if that applies in this context, given the U.S. title. So would an employer who owns their own child care facilities, either deducting their state corporate income tax by operating that, and then they say payroll deduct employees dependent care pre-tax, could they, do you know if they could spend that money on their own child care facility that they own, or is that the right hand dealing with the left?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, that is something I would have to research and get back to you at a later.
Okay, thanks. Worth a shot.
Okay, Representative Galvin.
Thank you. And Mr. Williams?
Williams.
Yes.
Through the chair, Mr. Williams, I'm just wondering if you had mentioned that it's you don't know what how to predict the number of participation or the rate of participation in this program, so it's difficult to know the amount of revenue that the state at large will not be receiving because it's going into this particular program. Am I hearing that right?
Through the chair, Representative, yes, that's correct. We just don't have the data to predict how much.
Do you know how many employers, how many corporations at large, number of corporations who have a corporate tax bill of $3 million or more in Alaska?
Through the chair to the representative, we could provide that information. I don't have that readily available, but we could provide that information after the meeting.
I imagine that'll get asked down the road. I think that's okay whenever you want that information. Thank you very much, Chair.
For the questions on the fiscal notes, seeing none, thank you very much, Mr. Williams. And I guess we're at the last stop here in terms of before I entertain a motion, I just want to make sure, see if there are any questions on the bill. I guess maybe we could go ahead and entertain a motion and then have a objection and have a discussion. So with that, Madam Co-Chair, I would entertain a motion, if it is the will of the committee, to go ahead and move this bill out of committee. Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Foster. I move House Bill 8933-LS0518/S as amended from the House Finance Committee with individual recommendations and forthcoming fiscal notes and give legislative legal permission to make technical and conforming changes.
Great. Thank you. I'll object for the purposes of some comments I think that are wanting to be made. Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I'm grateful for this bill. I've learned a lot from it. No doubt I could study it further and learn even more. It opens up some avenues, I think, for all children and their parents to benefit. My only concern is with something that actually Representative Stapp said, that he views this as an employee benefit issue. I think in my freshman year in 2013, then Representative Hughes, now Senator Hughes, had a bill that removed sort of the lower rung of corporate income tax because the totals were so de minimis relative to the major taxpayers. But I'm concerned about economic sectors like retail and how their children would benefit from the grants that or not the grants, the tax credits that are provided for largely heavy industry and other larger industries. Because I want something more than an employee benefit bill. Some people just aren't going to get the benefits. And I think that's where Representative Galvin's amendment came in and why I supported it. But the overall is headed in the right direction. I appreciate the work.
Okay, thank you. Any further comments on the bill before we Representative Galvin?
Thank you. In echoing Representative Josephson, I too am very grateful for a bill on addressing child care. Thank you. And I also appreciate that while we are changing the threshold of who can get support, what families can get extra help to pay for child care, we're really expanding that, which is wonderful. We're also expanding then more need for child care. So likely, right now, very few are actually taking in. 7% of eligible families are using these extra help, if you will, this extra help from the federal government. Now we're expanding it to where the feds and the state are going to be giving stipends to family to pay for child care or to help pay for child care. So what we're going to have is more need for more child care seats. And with that in mind, I appreciate that there is going to likely be a little bit of that need taken care of through the credits. The corporate credits will help with that a lot or to some degree. But I think we have a lot of work yet to do, and I look forward to this being the first step in making sure that our children are getting high-quality child care, and thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Representative Tomaszewski.
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Through the chair, I just wanted to thank Representative Colomb for all the hard work, the blood, sweat, and the tears that you have poured into this. I know you did a lot of work on this over the interim, and just wanted to thank you and congratulate you for this legislation. Thanks.
Okay, I am going to remove my objection, and seeing no other objections, House Bill 89, which is 33-LS0518/S, as amended, is reported out from the House Finance Committee with individual recommendations and forthcoming fiscal note, and give legislative legal permission to make technical and conforming changes, and I should say fiscal notes, plural. So with that, thank you very much, Representative Colomb and the committee. So next we're going to move over to House Bill 178. That's the Village Safe Water Facilities. Since the introduction of this bill last session, the Department of Environmental Conservation has changed its policies regarding the best practices score. I'd like to ask Acting Division of Water Director Jean McCabe, Facilities Program Manager Carrie Bowen, and Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development's Division of Community and Regional Affairs Director Sandra Muller to please come to the table, put yourselves on the record, and if you could walk us through some of the changes that were recently made. Thanks for being here.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Gene McCabe. I'm the Acting Division Director for Division of Water for the Department of Environmental Conservation.
Good afternoon. I'm Carrie Bohan. I am the Facilities Programs Manager with the Division of Water at DEC.
Great. Thank you. And, go ahead. And if you could tell us a little bit about the recent letter that was sent out to legislators just letting us know about the change to the scoring system. And that's largely what the bill was doing, and so we just wanted to have the department come forth and maybe tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, well, thank you, Mr. Chair, for that opportunity. I think I want to start off with to say that we've heard you. We've heard the request. And starting this financial funding cycle, the department has eliminated the use of management practice scores for eligibility criteria for Village Safe Water funding. We will handle and discuss the issues of capacity and sustainability as part of the project development as it moves along organically through the process. But the management practice scores will be still looked at and reviewed if they're voluntarily submitted through the project evaluation process, but they will not be a perceived barrier before even the discussion even begins.
Thank you. I'd just also like to note that Division of Community and Regional Affairs Director Sandra Moeller is also online. Feel free to chime in, Ms. Moeller, Director Moeller, if you have any comments. I will open it up to committee comments or questions. Do we have Representative Hannon?
Thank you, Chair Foster. I have not seen the letter that you've referenced, but I am going to trust that if you are satisfied that it addressed the concerns you had very directly asked last spring, that it does. But I guess for my records, I'd like a copy of the letter. I don't seem to have one in my file.
Let's take a brief at ease. Okay, House Finance, back on record at 2:41 p.m. Everybody should have one document, and it's printed on both sides. One is an email from the department, and then the other one is a letter. And maybe just to back up for a quick second, the impetus behind the bill is we just heard from a lot of small communities around the state. A lot of the entities representing those small communities, like, for example, Alaska Native Health Board and ANTHC, Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. And the problem is we've got a lot of small communities that are without water and sewer and or lacking or need upgrades. And sometimes the capacity, I know, is an issue. It's a little bit of a double-edged sword because on the one hand, you want these communities to be able to, you know, we put a lot of the money into investing in their infrastructure. And what happens is if you don't have anybody to maintain it, then, you know, it just, over time, it becomes just a big issue with having to, you know, replace it, or, you know, the problems compound if you don't have folks who can maintain them. So there is that one need, and that was part of the scoring system. But it was an issue in the sense that you also had these small communities that didn't maybe have as much capacity, and they're the ones who needed water and sewer the most. And if they, you know, are still hauling buckets of water or, you know, handling their sewer waste and bringing in buckets down to what looks like a mini trash bin in Anchorage, and folks just putting that in there, and you know, just years and years of not having, you know, a modern water and sewer system, and at the same time they're being held back because they couldn't score high enough because they didn't have the capacity maybe to, you know, maintain up to the standards that, you know, whether it's the state or the feds thought should be held to. It was this catch-22. And so we're just seeing so many communities who, you know, I think it was going back to, one of the governor, Representative Edgman helped me out here, who said we're going to put the honey bucket in the museum. That was Representative Tony Knowles, and I think that was back in the 90s, and we're still, you know, fighting this issue. And so, you know, there's some frustration there, and I know that, you know, we still need to maintain that some kind of a system and to make sure that these systems are being supported. But this was one way that we wanted to try to you know, speed up the process and figure out the problems later, I guess, is one way to look at that. And so this email that we had received from the Office of the Commissioner, and this is maybe the shorter of the two, good morning, DEC has heard the concerns expressed by communities and partners regarding the implementation of operations and maintenance best practices assessment tool for capital improvement project funding eligibility to more effectively meet the needs of communities, collaborate with our partners, and ensure the efficient and timely use of the available funds. DEC will no longer use O&M best practices as an eligibility criteria for Village Safe Water capital improvement project funding. So looks like this has been shared with the key stakeholders. The purpose of this meeting is we just wanted to, you know, make sure that we had this on the record, that we have this bill out there. It appears to be a resolved situation. I guess if there are any questions, I think probably the biggest question is if the scoring system goes away, you know, how do we move forward? And maybe if you could elaborate, knowing that there may still be a need to somehow assess, you know, in order to give funds out, what are we going to do? And again, Sandra Mueller, I don't know if you have any comments. I want to make sure. Are you there, by the way, Ms. Mueller?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chair.
Okay, just wanted to make sure we gave you an opportunity in case. But with that, go
ahead. Sure. Again, Carrie Bohan, the Facilities Programs Manager with the Division of Water at DEC. So, I think first it's important to note that we're not doing away with the operations and maintenance best practices tool altogether. We are simply removing that as a criteria for eligibility for project funding. We think it's an important tool, and our partners at the Rural Utility Business Advisor agree that we need a way to keep a good pulse on how the communities are doing in the financial, managerial, and technical categories so that we can best help help us understand where we can allocate resources to provide support. We have programs both in the Department of Commerce, the Department of Environmental Conservation. There are outside technical agencies that get funding through federal funding partners, and we all work collaboratively to try and provide support for communities in that ongoing effort to both build and maintain capacity. So we will still offer that opportunity to use the tool. Communities have always been given the option as to whether or not they want to participate. I think obviously when the funding eligibility was tied to that tool, there was a feeling that they had to participate, and I appreciate that. Now it's maybe that communities will choose not to participate, but it will be used as a component of our project scoring, but the bulk of the score is really based on the health impact of the project that's being provided, and unserved and underserved communities also get additional points, acknowledging that those are the communities that most need the improvements. So I think I hope that the perception of the tool will change over time, and it will be seen as something that's a resource to communities, and perhaps we need to continue to talk about whether or not the metrics as they're specifically written out right now are as effective as we would like for them to be. So we're happy to engage in that conversation ongoing with our partners and communities. Mostly moving away from it being an eligibility criteria to just another resource that we have to make available to work with communities.
Great. Thank you very much. So it sounds like a little bit of gray area. It's not going away, but maybe hopefully not a barrier to funding, or at least maybe less so. I guess as we move forward, we'll kind of see. But this is definitely good news, and I appreciate that. Representative Hannon?
Thank you, Chair Foster, and I'm not trying to beat a dead horse. The letter uses an I pronoun but doesn't provide us a signature, and so I'm just curious who the letter is from, whether it's commissioner level or
Through the chair, Representative Hannon. So I believe the document that you received was an email that I crafted to go to key stakeholders such as regional health corporations, ANTHC, Alaska Municipal League, and that was shared. Thank you. We followed that email up with a letter that I think actually physically made it in the mail this Monday to all of the communities that are eligible for Village Safe Water funding that announced this year's funding opportunity, which kicks off next Monday. So as part of that community letter, we let them know of the changes in the way we're administering the program this year. Thank you.
Great, thank you. So I feel like we're moving in the direction of where I'd like to see us go. So we may not be hitting the target right at the bullseye. We just don't know at this point until we kind of move forward and see how things work. But I do appreciate your work on this. Representative Edgman?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And I want to thank the department for coming forward with an alternative mechanism to what really before was a tool that was pretty effective when there wasn't a lot of funding coming in the Village Safe Water Tool program. But with last year's roughly $250 million, this year's $262 million into essentially water and sewer facilities in Alaska, that's $500 million. We needed to come up with something different that would not be prohibitive in terms of communities, smaller communities who, even today with the scoring system, may still lack the operational capabilities to maintain utility, to maintain the ratepayers paying their bills and really the maintenance of the whole facility. So I really appreciate this, Ms. Bohannon. I I was told that you took the lead on this project, and I want to thank you for that. And, you know, the devil's in the details. So we hope to, Mr. Co-Chair, with this bill and your bill, and be able to sort of work this through and see what kind of results this produces, because we cannot have small communities out there not be able to take advantage of this funding. We simply can't. And I think the department recognizes that. You and I certainly recognize that. And I hope this is a step forward in the right direction. And we don't have a situation like Bethel that last year, sort of the poster child, a $19 million opportunity sort of went by the wayside because it couldn't meet a certain, you know, criteria in this very sort of prescriptive scoring mechanism that was in place. And I'll get off my soapbox here, but I think it's a good move, and we'll be monitoring it closely.
Thank you. Any final comments before I make Representative Cronk?
Thank you, Mr. Kozier. Thank you guys for definitely looking into this. I look in the lower box, and 13 of those communities are communities that I serve. In the upper box, at least 4 of those are. So thank you for, you know, addressing this and making it a priority.
Okay. Any final comments from the department?
No, I don't think so. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. I'd just like to say we'll be setting this HB 178 bill aside indefinitely, which you probably don't see committees killing their own bills too often, but that's the intent. So so with that, we are going to move to our final bill today, and that is House Bill 193, Internet for Schools. I'd like to invite Representative Edgman to please come to the table. And he'll be giving us a brief recap of the bill, and then also available for questions. We have in the room Karen Morrison, Director of School Finance and Facilities, and online is Faye Tanner, the E-Rate Coordinator from the Department of Education, to discuss the mechanism of funding related to the bill. And then also available from Legislative Finance, we have Connor Bell. So with that, Representative Edgman, did you want to make some opening comments?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. This bill came before the committee late last May. I think it was not too long before we actually adjourned. And what the bill does, in like just a matter of a few sentences, is it allows school districts to utilize a state program that was set up in 2014 to be able to compete for higher levels of megabytes per second. Actually, a program that started at 10 megabytes per second graduated in 2020 to 25 megabytes per second. And now we propose in this legislation to up that internet capability to 100 megabytes per second. But through the state's broadband assistance grant program, schools, both primary, secondary, libraries as well, can qualify to actually access federal money through the Federal Universal Services Program. And it's pretty unique because it's up to, for every state dollar that's involved, maybe matched by $8 or $9 of federal money. But it does involve an application process. It does involve a change in statute. And Mr. Chairman, that's what this bill would propose, and really appreciate you bringing the bill before the committee.
Great. Thank you very much. Let's see here. Maybe we'll go ahead and if we could have you both put yourselves on the record, and then we'll open it up for questions of the committee.
For the record, my name is Karen Morrison, and I serve as the Director of Finance and Support Services for the Department of Education and Early Development.
Okay. Good afternoon. My name is Laurel Shoup. I'm the Legislative Liaison for the Department of Education and Early Development.
Thank you. Does the committee have any questions? Okay. I would also... we'll go ahead and move over to public testimony on HB 193, Internet for Schools. Before I open it up, if anyone is watching online, you can submit public testimony by sending us an email to house.finance@akleg.gov. Again, that's house.finance@akleg.gov. So with that... it looks like we've got somebody online. Maybe we'll go to the room. Is there anyone in the room who would like to testify? I feel like there might be a list here. Yes. Maybe if I could have, or if you'd like to come up, and then if I could just get a copy of the list. I don't know if there are multiple names on there, then we'll go online. Okay, if you'd like to come up and put yourself on the record, just if you could state your name and your affiliation and proceed with your testimony. Thanks for joining us today.
Sure. Thank you. Sorry, there was no one on the list. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dr. Madeline Aguillard. I'm the superintendent for the Cusbuck School District. And I wanted to testify in support of HB 193 and really wanted to just reiterate what this would do for the students of my district if this went through. So I'll give you a snapshot of what it looks like right now with 25. Even in my smallest schools, you know, where I might have 10 students, to our larger schools with over 100, we have to stagger our state testing. So even with 10 students in the building, in order to put, because all of the state testing is online, in order to make that a success, we have to build extra schedules and monitor when they're signing into devices. We have remote tech directors that monitor our bandwidth usage, and we max out every site every day. And we watch it to the, we watch every device that hits our network. And then additionally, the access to online courses. And so I spoke with one of my directors, and right now for perspective, we have about 50 classes that are online across my district. We might only have about 310 students, but that's a very large percentage of our classwork for core classes that are online, and because we don't have the teachers. You know, we have a whole school that has no certified staff. Their coursework is on the computer all day long, every day, kindergarten through 12th grade. Without this, we can't provide an access to an education. And so it's very crucial, even, you know, for as small as our population is, we're very, very, very reliant on it, and it's much needed. So thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. And can you repeat your name again?
Dr. Madeline Aguillard.
Okay, great. Thank you. Do we have any questions for Dr. Aguilar? Great. Okay, seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the room who would like to testify? We have... please come up, and if you can state your name. Have you also signed in as well? Great, perfect, okay. And if you can state your name and your affiliation.
Kim Hanisch, I'm the superintendent in Unalaska City School District. Apologize for my dress, I just flew in. So thank you for interest in this bill. As you might know, in Unalaska, we did get fiber optics this past year, and so we have the potential of being at 100 megabytes. If we went up to 100, we would have lost all E-rate funding. We opted to increase to 50, losing most of our E-rate funding. So now it's costing us more to have the 50, which seems kind of counterintuitive that it's costing more for a service that's sitting right there for us to take advantage of. If we stayed at 25, we'd be throwing away the potential but saving money. So I can tell you in the classrooms, her story when it comes to testing, all of that, at 50, we're a whole different beast, I guess, when it comes to providing services that students can access resources in a way that other people are already accessing those resources. So I definitely encourage the movement of this bill so that we can get funding accordingly.
Great, thank you. And your name again?
Kim Hanisch.
Kim Hanisch. You're with Cusbuck, is that right?
Unalaska.
Oh, Unalaska. Oh, okay. Oh, great. I was going to say, you mentioned you had just flown in and your dress, and I was thinking, oh, I'm feeling actually more at home. Just it makes me want to throw some snow pants on or something. We've got, which I do regularly wear here in Juneau, actually. Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Superintendent Hanisch. I just basically wanted to say a comment. Thank you. I know that I've read recently about Unalaska's issues with the costs of your utilities being exponentially up, and I imagine that combined with broadband costs and still managing to get to the hard work of teaching our kids. I just wanted to say thank you. Really appreciate it. Thanks for being here.
Okay. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Can I ask, first of all, how long have you been the superintendent there at in Onalaska?
Thank you. My first year.
Oh, okay, okay. The reason I ask is that my daughter taught there a few years ago, but she left. But in any case, so have things been getting better? I know that they weren't good at all for internet when she was there, but over the last year or two, have things been getting better? Or are we still at the level likely where she was when she was there?
No, so I'm very fortunate. So this is the first year that we've had the fiber optics and increased to 50, and it's a world of difference. The story is that they tell me. I can't tell much of a difference being in Onalaska or being in Anchorage for the service that we have now. Yeah.
And again, thank you for being here on this important topic. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Stapp.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Through the chair, I just wanted to get on the action here from Rep. Ortiz. I just want to say I thought John Conwell was an amazing superintendent. I love being in your school, and I think it was successful back then when I was there, and I think it'll be more successful in the future. So,
thank you. He was amazing. Stepping into a school district that has systems in place and a good chance to even do greater things.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you for your testimony. And I think we've got one other person in the room, Dr. Lisa Parody. And then also we have at least one person online and maybe three possibly. So we'll go to the phones in a moment. But with that, Dr. Parody, if you could put yourself on the record, state your name, your affiliation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee for the opportunity to briefly testify this morning. Or I guess it's the afternoon now. The Alaska Council, for the record, my name is Dr. Lisa Skiles Parody. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Council of School Administrators, and we represent superintendents, all principals, school business officials, and school districts in general. And I've testified on this bill. I was just saying to one of the staff multiple times over the last years because the nature of how important this is to our most remote and rural schools really can't be measured. HB 193 would raise the cap for broadband assistance grants to the FCC minimum standard for bandwidth in schools. And, you know, we really believe that our students deserve that. As we saw in many rural and remote school districts in Alaska during the COVID pandemic, there was clear digital inequity between our rural and remote schools with our urban schools. The schools in urban districts were able to flip to virtual and digital instruction, and our students in our rural and remote areas really were stuck with paper and pencil packets. And if we went to another pandemic, God forbid, it would be the same way today. And I think that's just a plain and simple equity issue, straight up equity. And we need to address it. It's time. We have the new infrastructure coming in from our federal infrastructure grants that are building out, and it's time to support our districts to rise to this level. And even this level is low, given levels in, say, for example, Anchorage. So it's just time to do it. Access to vital bandwidth is necessary. It's for basic day-to-day learning, but also to innovate learning, and it creates efficiencies. It also supports communities for online health services. It helps our students keep pace with peers globally and is essential where infrastructure is extremely limited or non-existent. So just in short, ACSA supports this connectivity. We also support school-to-home connectivity and really feel like geography should not determine our learning opportunities, and keeping school districts artificially capped at 25 is doing just that. So thank you so much for your time. We urge you to pass this bill. I know it's being discussed in lots of different ways, but we are against the timeline. And if we keep districts capped for another year at 25, it's just not okay. So thank you for your time, and appreciate your consideration.
Thank you. Dr. Parody, I think we've got a few questions. I know we're going to have Representative Hannon. I just wanted to emphasize the deadline. That number, I've heard a couple different dates. I know it's at the end of February, but from your standpoint, that date is what again?
Mr. Chairman, the date is February 27th.
Thank you.
The districts, and that is because the districts have to apply, their paperwork has to be in a month later, and they have to provide notice for a month. So 227s are drop dead. They have a required notice period, and like almost immediately a month later is when that paperwork has to be in.
Great. Thank you, Representative Hennen. Oh, that was the question. Okay, Representative Edgman.
Yeah, I just want to thank Dr. Parity for her leadership on this program, because it started about 10 years ago at 10 megabytes per second, and here we are today, hopefully, with the will of the legislature, increasing it to 100 megabytes, which in a couple of years will probably be inadequate for a number of schools. It's already sort of the floor as opposed to the ceiling. But just wanted to take a pause and thank you for your work on the program.
Through the chair, Co-Chairman Edgman, thank you very much. You two have, we've walked this path together, Senator Olson, Senator Hoffman, and you, Representative Edgman. I remember us working on those first bag bill 10 and increasing it to 25, and now it's time to take the next leap. And so thank you for your leadership on this bill.
Thank you very much. Okay, next we'll go to the phone lines, unless there's anyone else in the audience who would like to testify. I'm not seeing any. So if we could go to Amy Eakin, looks like calling in. Ms. Eakin, are you online? If you are there, if you could state your name and your affiliation, where are you calling in from?
Yes, I am here. Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the House Finance Committee. This is Amy Aiken, and I serve as the Director of Technology for Northwest Arctic Borough School District. I appreciate the opportunity to address you today and in here to advocate for an increase in the broadband assistant grant from the current 25 megabits per second to 100 megabits per second per school. As you're well aware, access to broadband is no longer a luxury, but it's a fundamental necessity for education in the 21st century. In our remote region, where geographic isolation is compounded by harsh weather conditions, broadband connectivity plays an even more critical role. The current broadband assistance grant of 25 megabits per school is insufficient to meet the needs of our current and growing demands of learning and general operations in our district. With the increase of online educational curricula, testing and business operations, our bandwidth requirements have escalated dramatically in recent years. At 25 megabits per second, our students, educators, and staff are frequently confronted with frustratingly slow internet speeds. This hinders their ability to access and utilize online materials, do simple tasks like take attendance and enter their grades, and run general everyday business operations effectively. The State of Alaska 5-year action plan for Internet for All Alaska that was published back in September cited Broadband Now's annual rankings, stating that Alaska ranks 51st for Internet coverage speed and availability. 51st. So consider your own home. How many of you, or me, myself, run our own homes on 25 megabits per second or less? I certainly don't. I have way more than that in my own house. Our largest school up here has only 25 megabits per second for all 370 students and staff. Our second largest school has 351 students and staff that all share 25 megabits per second. In order to manage that limited bandwidth, we have to implement extensive measures, such as website blocking, per-device access throttling, and the restriction of personal devices. Additionally, we actively manage the network to prevent updates and software deployments between the hours of 9 a.m. and 3:30 p.m. That is a precautionary measure taken to safeguard educational experience of both our students and our staff, and to ensure uninterrupted access to essential resources during those critical learning hours. During state testing times, we can only allow 20 students to test at one time. Having each student stagger the start of their tests. We have had students kicked off of their test when a sole teacher in another classroom started a YouTube video. This required the technology department to narrow down the issue and make sure nobody, no teachers, stream content during testing time. We already blocked student streaming. Some of our students have had to restart their test 5 to 6 times just because it stalls out from limited bandwidth. I've heard folks say, especially this year, well, why don't you just use Starlink then? This past summer, Quintillion fiber was spliced, which left our district without internet in Kotzebue, which is the main district hub. I mounted a Starlink satellite within a day to keep operations going. Starlink has proved quite quickly to be a promising solution and of adequate quality for the interim. Within 1 week, that dish was vandalized and no longer functioned. Someone threw a rock at it and broke the dish. I did replace the dish, and we successfully navigated the loss of the fiber through the rest of the summer and beginning the school year. With that said, this experience was in Kotzebue only. The Northwest Arctic Borough School District has 13 schools and a district office that require internet access and spans the geographical region comparable to the size of the state of Indiana. We have some of the harshest climate in the country, which impacts the sustainability of our structures and our ease of travel. The technology department consists of 3 technicians, a network administrator, and myself. We heavily rely on the support of our internet service provider to keep internet operations functional and updated in all of our villages. Starlink does not provide support services. In addition, consider the weather. We ended up mounting Starlink dish on the roof of our building this past summer, but had to wait for it to be safe for our maintenance department to do that. Weather is a safety concern when climbing on our roofs. If a dish were mounted in any of our villages and needed to be replaced during the winter, this would not happen due to safety. Ice, snow, winds. Our current internet service provider, they're under a contract to make sure we have internet. If there's an outage, they have to fix it. Selowik McQueen School is one of our largest schools and is currently in 25 megabits. They struggle on a daily basis to do simple things like open power school to take attendance or intergrades. Teachers routinely wait 3 to 5 minutes for power school to even load. Back in 2017, when we were stuck at 15 megabits per second, the district increased Selowik bandwidth because they were not able to operate at that level. Because that increased the time, now Selowik does not qualify to receive bag funds. Now I'm sitting in that same critical position again. If I mount a Starlink satellite out there to help supplement their service, I jeopardize any future funding with bag since Starlink is more than 25 megabits. If I don't supplement with Starlink, learning and operations on a daily basis are a constant struggle. And even if I did buy a dish, we can't even mount it on the Selowik school until next summer due to safety issues. And then walking down that road, if it breaks, it would be the following summer before we could mount another replacement. Starlink at this time is not a viable service for our region. We cannot test it beyond what we did in Kotzebue either without putting back funding at risk. I've actually talked about the impact of 25 megabits on our simple operations. Our children deserve an equitable education, including distance learning and online resources that support their learning potentials and their interests.
Ms. Eakin, I'm sorry, if you could maybe wrap up.
Sure. Our school districts are currently under a timeline crunch in order to be eligible for bag funds. We need, some districts may need to put out an RFP that needs to start by February 28th. Other districts simply need to file for the increase, which needs to be done by March 27th or at the very latest April 10th for a late filing. I do thank you for your attention on this critical issue, and I'm available for any additional information or questions you may have.
Great, thank you. We've got a question from Representative Stout.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Again, you've had another privilege to be able to go to the Northwest Arc Pearl School District on a handful of times in my life. Really, thank you for kind of telling us about the issues you've had with Starlink and some of the challenges. I did hear you mention your ISP all the time, but I'm curious, who is your actual internet service provider there at Northwest Arc Pearl?
GCI.
Thanks.
Okay, do we have any further questions of the committee? Okay, I don't see any. Thank you very much, Ms. Eakin, for your testimony. Let's move over to, let's see, it looks like under testimony there are a couple of people who have said yes, but I think they're here for questions. They're with the departments. And then there's some people under testimony that have put down they're here for questions, but I think they're really for testimony. So I think, see, Jennifer Eller, looks like you're marked down as a yes. Calling you from Unalakleet, if you could state your name and your affiliation, proceed with your testimony.
Yes, hi, my name is Jennifer Eller. I am the Director of Educational Technology and Infrastructure for the Barron Street School District in Unalakleet, Alaska. Good afternoon, Honorable Co-Chairs Edmund Foster and Johnson, distinguished members of the House Finance Committee. It's a pleasure to speak with you today about this important issue that our schools are facing. I have a combined 23 years of experience in technology in the educational field. I have a Master of Science degree in Educational Technology and a Cybersecurity Certificate. I have worked for the Bering Strait School District for 4.5 years. Today, I come to you in favor of passing the HB 193 Internet for Schools Bill. School districts in rural communities of Alaska have been plagued with a lack of access to affordable high-speed internet for years. However, the Alaska School Broadband Assistance Grant has made it possible for school districts to increase speeds while reducing the additional financial burden that this would bring to a rural district. Currently, internet for the Bering Strait School District is capped at 25 megabits per second, as this is the current maximum speed that is allowed with the bag. Delivering internet to our communities is not an easy feat, nor is it cheap. And moving beyond this cap to 50 or 100 megabits per second would not be financially tenable without the support of the bag. Despite its importance in modern education, the cost of internet access is not always adequately accounted for in the base student allocation funding. As a result, rural districts like ours often rely on programs like E-Rate and BAG to cover a substantial portion of the cost of internet services in our schools. Internet access for schools in rural Alaska can no longer be looked at as an accessory to learning. It is a necessity and imperative to provide an equitable 21st century educational experience to all students, and the cost of internet service should not be the wheel that drives the educational inequalities further apart. According to the draft of the State of Alaska Digital Equity Plan, 80% of Alaskans cannot get broadband at an affordable price, while 21% of Alaskans are not able to purchase a broadband plan that is considered high-speed internet. Based on these statistics, having internet access at school is the only time that a majority of students experience the learning opportunities available with high-speed internet. The draft also goes on to explain that school districts are community anchors and have played a key role in mitigating challenges that communities have faced and are critical to ensuring success in addressing digital equity in coming years. The only way that we can continue to be one of the community anchors that play that key role in decreasing digital inequalities is by passing the HB 193 legislation. This will increase the bandwidth cap to 100 megabits per second and provide the funding to help rural schools like ours meet the needs of our students and provide them with the education they deserve. Finally, limited internet access also creates significant problems during state testing, as we are unable to operate at speeds greater than 25 megabits per second. As a result, we must stagger testing start times and, for the most part, only test one classroom at a time, which not only disrupts the normal flow of the school day for weeks, but also hinders opportunities for advanced instruction. I would like to thank Ms. Eakin for her testimony as she explained some of those very same struggles that we have encountered at BSSC. And I just strongly urge the House Finance Committee to pass House Bill 193, Internet for Schools. In doing so, show your support for rural education by improving internet access in Alaska schools and ensuring that Alaska students have the tools they need to succeed in the digital age. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Eller. We've got a question from Representative Stapp.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I'm through the chair to Ms. Eller. I feel like I'm three for three today. I saw your longtime business manager in the hall, Mr. Vink, and I just want to say I love UNICLEAD. I think you have an amazing school. I am curious, though, too, who is the ISP provider for Bering Strait School District?
Currently, it's GCI.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much, Ms. Eller. For the next two people I've got on the list under testimony, it looks like I've got they're available for questions, but I just wanted to double check to see if you're actually wanting to testify. First, we've got Faye Tanner from Kenai and then Christine O'Connor from Wasilla. Ms. Tanner, were you wanting to testify or are you available for questions?
Of the record, this is Faye Tanner. I'm available for questions.
Great, thank you. And Christine O'Connor, are you wanting to testify or were you available for questions? And it looks like we are through the list. Is there anyone else in the audience who'd like to testify? Is there anyone online that I may have missed who'd like to testify? And I'm not hearing anyone, so it looks like we're good. Okay, I'll go ahead and close public testimony on HB 193, Internet for Schools. Again, if folks would like to submit written testimony, they can do so by sending an email to house.finance@akleg.gov. I was going to recognize a representative, but looks like he's gone. So with that, let's see here. Next up, we have a fiscal note, and that's from the Department of Education. If we could have Director Morrison come to the table, and if you could put yourself on the record and walk us through the fiscal note.
Good afternoon. Thank you. For the record, my name is Karen Morrison, and I am the Director of Finance and Support Services for the Department of Education and Early Development. Today, I'm presenting the department's fiscal note for the broadband assistance grant component in the department's budget for House Bill 193, referencing OMB component 3004. This bill amends Alaska Statute 1403-127, funding for internet services. This statute provides the authority to the department to provide state-funded grants to Alaska school districts for the purposes of increasing their internet download speeds up to 25 megabits per second. House Bill 193 would amend the maximum allowable download speed in the school broadband assistance grant to 100 megabits per second. In fiscal 23, the Alaska State Legislature appropriated $6.6 million in funding to school broadband assistant grant program. This appropriation provided grants to 151 eligible schools to help those districts reach up to the maximum download speed of 25 megabits per second. The 33rd Legislature appropriated $6.7 million in this fiscal year to the school broadband assistance program that provided state grants to 136 school districts to reach up to the maximum download speed of 25 megabits per second. The department posted a request for information on the state of Alaska's online public notices website. The title of this RFI was School Internet Service Increased Cost Estimate. The department sought input from Alaska's internet service industry to estimate the total projected funding needs for schools to increase their internet download speeds from the maximum allowable of 25 megabits per second to the 100 megabits per second. Although the department received responses that provided general narrative descriptive pricing changes, the information the department received was limited due to proprietary processes that were kept confidential. Additionally, it's unknown how many newly eligible schools will apply for the school broadband access grant if the funding cap is increased to allow download speeds up to 100 megabits per second. The department's fiscal note reflects its understanding of the potential fiscal impact to the department should the maximum download speed be raised to 100 megabits per second when more newly eligible schools apply for the program. The department's fiscal note estimates $39.4 million would be needed to provide funding to the potentially newly eligible schools. The department would require 1.5% indirect rate adjustment for administration of the program, which would continue to be used to process grant applications and award funding to schools.
Thank you very much. We've got a few questions, Representative Stapp, and then Galvin.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair, the folks attended. Indeed. So I heard you say that you talked about you tried to get updated information as far as where this goes to the ISP, but the proprietary information. How many vendors did you go to request that information?
Ms. Shoup?
For the record, Laurel Shoup, Legislative Liaison and Special Assistant to the Commissioner, Department of Education and Early Development, through the chair. Thank you for your question, Representative Stapp. We listed it publicly on the OPN, also known as the Online Public Notices, State of Alaska website. We received 5 responses from vendors, but again, to reiterate what Director Morrison alluded to, a lot of those were narrative responses. They did not give concrete or reliable information that we could base a projection on, so we've decided to remain with our fiscal note.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Galvin.
Thank you very much, through the co-chair Foster. My question was similar. I'm curious to know more about that process, because I wondered if you're in your consideration, could it be that some vendors might serve parts of Alaska but not other parts? So are you anticipating bifurcating that? Or as I think about 25 going up to 100, for example, and I'm not an IT person, but it, you know, if I'm just multiplying up from the 6.7 million, I get to different numbers. So I'm just trying to understand how those costs were anticipated. I assume then that you have multiple vendors that you might be using. Is that your expectation? I guess let's start with that.
Through the chair, thank you for the question, Representative Galvin. We do have a list of vendors. It's publicly available. So E-rate data is publicly available on the USAC website. Mm-hmm. So all of those vendors would be considered for the information through our online public notices. In reference to your question on how we arrived at this particular number, your assumption is correct. It is a linear projection, and that's what we have used to base our data.
I'm going to do more homework on this. Thank you so much.
Hey, Representative Stapp.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair. So, okay, very simple problem, right? So basically, you have E-rate data. You have ISP providers, so basically you give money to school districts give the money to internet service providers doesn't tell you what the price is. So my question is, let's say the price is actually double what we think it is, do we pay that money next year in a supplemental in the event that the bill passes? That's my question. Are we on the hook for the money that we don't necessarily know how much it is?
Through the chair, thank you for the question, Representative Stapp. We would prorate awards should there not be sufficient funding for FY25 awards that we calculate. The awards would be prorated to those districts. That's written in our regulations.
So follow up, Co-Chair Foster. Okay, so if we're wrong and we have to prorate the money, prorate the rates of the district, what does that actually look like? Does that mean they only get 75 or 78 megabytes per second? What is that? Explain that to me.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, for the record, Laurel Shoup. So it would be proportional to all of the awards. So as an example, if there were $100 that we had available and we actually needed $200, so that would be prorated, distributed evenly throughout all of the different school districts. So it wouldn't necessarily be based on what they were awarded through the E-rate program or something similar. It would be based on a proration that would be evenly distributed.
And one last follow-up, Co-Chair Foster. Yeah, through the chair. So, again, so we would prorate that. So, but my understanding is you wouldn't know what that is until after the fact. Is that correct, or would you know ahead of time based on the contract the ISP provider?
Thank you for the question. For the record, Laurel Shoup, through the chair, Representative Stapp. We know how much funding is appropriated by the legislature, by you all. The applications that come in, we do not necessarily know what the funding costs are. Dr. Parody alluded a little bit to that process. So there's a formal process that school districts have to apply for their E-rate funding. And that happens, and maybe Director Morrison could speak more to what that process looks like from a school district perspective. However, the majority of school districts are on contracts. I would say the majority of them may be five-year contracts. So they do know what their costs are, but again, we don't know which schools will apply necessarily. We don't have a forecast. We have what has historically happened, but that would remain to be determined.
And I have one last follow-up, Co-Chair Foster.
Yep,
thank you, Co-Chair Foster. The last one, I promise, through the chair. So the final aspect of that process will be, so what we are effectively doing is we're giving money for rural internet providers. They go to that money is basically passed through to the ISP for the broadband access grants. What do we know about price transparency from the ISP? Do we have any mechanism to know that the providers are just not charging whatever because they know they're going to get a bunch of state money?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, Laurel Shoup for the record. The question was, is there transparency in what the ISP internet service providers are charging for school districts? The E-rate program, as I spoke about earlier, has an open data source, the USAC website, where all of their pricing is posted. So that information is publicly available.
Thank you.
Representative Edgman.
So it's true, though, that the application process is very extensive. And I've not done one myself, obviously, but I know that the application process from the school itself and the criteria through the Federal Universal Services Program is fairly rigid as well. I know this anecdotally, talking to school districts. I also know that the number of applicants a couple years ago, I think it was 151, that went down to 130-something range. Is that correct? And you could view this program, a vital program for the services it provides, as a bridge towards the future as we get more, as the Unalaska superintendent indicated, more fiber into communities and more other high-speed internet opportunities, whether it's satellite or microwave transmission or what have you. So a reasonable sort of outlook would be that just extrapolating forward, there could be less applicants this year. It could be less next year, we hope, we think. But the sense that we might sort of overreach or have to come back for a supplemental, or maybe the applicants just sort of overwhelm the program, to me, and I appreciate the line of question because I think they're legitimate questions, but to me, doesn't seem to be as realistic as it theoretically could be. But I guess that's more of a statement. I don't see you nodding your head yes or no, but I do know that more schools are finding other means, not a great amount, but other means of getting high-speed internet.
And we've got Christine O'Connor online. I know she's an expert in some of these areas. I'd like to give her an opportunity. Christine, if you're there, if you could put yourself on the record, state your name, your affiliation.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Wilson. Christine O'Connor, Executive Director, Alaska Telecom Association.
And maybe if you could weigh in, if you've got anything to offer on this.
I do. Thank you, Chairman. A couple thoughts come to mind in this discussion. One is that we have fiber networks deploying across the state now, thankfully, due to infrastructure funding. And as those fiber networks are coming into towns, of course, the schools want to take advantage. Another thing that's happening as these networks are being deployed is in many areas you see rates are coming down. Also, a lot more capacity is available at the same rates. So when you look at what the cost is going to be, it's not a simple linear, just take the current amount times whatever number of years, because that's not really, that is not how broadband pricing works. We're also seeing a lot of rate compression as the new networks are coming in. And then the third factor that affects this is the E-rate's competitive bidding process, which you've kind of touched on. It's very rigorous. It's very transparent. The schools put out RFPs, and every provider that can serve the area responds to them. And we're seeing more activity and more responses, which increases competition, drives down prices. There are very strict rules on how the competition process works. So it's difficult, and there's no way that you know what the actual rate will be until the competitive RFP process plays out. So it's difficult to get to, like, this will be the price for this school. The only way you truly know that is after the bidding process. But what we have seen over since the beginning of the original BAG program is that these rates have been compressed year after year after year. We've seen them come down over several years. When we were discussing the original school bag program, the rates were dropping over 30%. So I think we're still seeing that. I think those are the main points I wanted to make. Thank you. And if I've missed something, please ask. Thank you, Chairman.
Great. Thank you very much. Further questions on fiscal note 3004? I don't see Representative Stapp.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I know I said my last one was last time, but the speaker just said kind of it's my curiosity. So through the chair, you mentioned competitive RFP process. How many people bid on the last RFP?
I don't know that specifically. Every school district puts out their own RFP. So there are dozens of RFPs. And then there are actually federal regulations that say every provider, so every telecom provider that participates in the Universal Service Program has to respond. So they all do. So that turns into dozens of schools and many, many responses. And the database that was mentioned earlier is very easy to access and pull this down in a spreadsheet and look at the data.
Thank you.
That's at USAC.org.
Okay, further questions on the fiscal notes? Seeing none. Thank you very much to the department. With that, I would propose an amendment deadline, unless it is the will of the committee to want to move past that. I don't know if there are amendments that are out there. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. You know, I think both with the testimony that we heard today and with the past knowledge that we have with this BAG bill, we're all aware of the deadline that's coming up here. A couple of the folks who testified talked about that deadline. I sense that there's broad-based support for making sure that we do a good job of providing access to a better job anyway, of providing access to internet for rural districts. So I would like this committee to consider just moving this bill today. I don't think there. I'm just kind of probing the rest of the committee if there'd be a will to do that.
Thank you. If folks did not intend to introduce an amendment, then I would not set an amendment deadline if there was no need for that. Does anyone think that they need time for an amendment?
Chair, I was considering an amendment.
Okay. Okay, so with that in mind, we'll set an amendment deadline for next Tuesday, February 13th at noon. If you could email or deliver your amendments to my staff, Rhody Anderson, or the finance clerk, Helen Phillips, by Tuesday, February 13th at noon. So before I announce tomorrow's meeting, or actually Monday's meeting, is there anything else for the good of the order? I don't see anything. So with that, our next scheduled House Finance Committee meeting is next Monday, February 12th at 1:30 p.m. And so just a reminder of House Finance, there is no House Finance tomorrow, so we'll be meeting Monday. So with that, we will be adjourned at 3:41 p.m. Thank you.